Every day is election day.
The question is, you know, can I formulate a plan and do I have something really to contribute?
A talk with the author of a book that tells women how to run for office, plus the future of Mormons in politics and Native Americans taking stewardship of ancestral lands. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. Women are increasingly showing up as leaders of government. According to the Center for American Women in Politics, in 2013, 98 of the 535 seats in the U.S. Congress are held by women. 75 women hold statewide elected executive posts, and the proportion of women in state legislatures is at 24%. But for many women, there's still a self-imposed barrier, a feeling that it's just too hard, or we don't have what it takes. Author Rebecca Sive has written a book that breaks down that wall, spelling out just what is required to be an effective leader, what it takes to run for office, and how to make a difference. It's called Every Day is Election Day, a woman's guide to winning any office, from the PTA to the White House.
It seems to me we're in a new era now. And there are now several generations of women who are, you know, seeking public leadership and political leadership roles. And I just thought, well, we've got a wealth of wisdom and a wealth of truth-telling.
Rebecca, traditionally, men have approached politics as a career. Do you think women will do the same thing?
And I think historically, as you may know, women have not. They tend to wait longer, in part because if they have children, you know, most of them have significant child care responsibilities, or they wait to be asked, and if you wait to be asked, it always takes longer. You know, there are some barriers that have been identified, but I think increasingly, you know, younger and younger women are deciding to, you know, go for the stars. I mean, there are women out there now in their 30s and 40s, you know, running for U.S. Senate and the Congress for sure. I think it's been true historically that women came at it a little bit differently and a little bit later, but I think increasingly women decide. And then the question is, you know, can I formulate a plan and do I have something really to contribute?
And if the answer to those is yes, how do you begin?
Well, I have a chapter early in the book called Your Personality Self-Test, and what I realized as I was interviewing women, and I should just say I interviewed women from all over the country in differing backgrounds and political experiences, I realized that as I was doing that there were a series of characteristics that, you know, or qualities that women need to evaluate. If I want to be, say, an elected official, you know, and that requires fundraising, can I be comfortable with that? And can I be comfortable with talking to the media? And can I be comfortable with, you know, going to the state fair and eating hot dogs? And, you know, sort of a series of things that are listed in that chapter to say, well, you know, you don't have to score 100 on every one of them, but you do need to think through, do I have the key qualities, and to the extent that I may have some of them in greater measure than others, you know, how does that mix come together for me?
And I realize that today's young women are different from their mothers, but it has traditionally been true that women tend to be pleasers. So when you want to go into public office, how important is it, A, that you want people to like you, and B, that you're okay when they don't?
Really good question. I will say that a lot of politicians I've met over the years are people, male and female, are people who like to be liked. You know, the sort of classic example is, you know, people talk about sometimes is Bill Clinton. You know, he'll shake hands forever. But, you know, you sort of have to be like being around people, because even if it's an appointed office you're seeking, you know, you have to convince people to be your supporters. At the same time, you have to understand that in great measure, you know, some people will dislike you because of the stance you take on certain issues, and that's not, you can't take that personally. So with the people who you know, are really good at this, it seems to me they are able to both like people and separate themselves from feeling it personally, and therefore, win or lose, particularly lose, they're able to sort of jump back in and keep going, which of course is really important.
And you do point out you must be prepared to lose, because chances are you will at some point.
Yeah. I think that that's one of the really, really important lessons that, you know, I've thought about, and I think about this with a lot of the issues we work on, too. You know, you just have to stick with the issue, and some campaigns are going to prevail and others are not. There are all kinds of examples of women who've, you know, Hillary Clinton being probably the easiest one to grab a hold to, but, you know, of recovering from considerable loss or maybe even embarrassment and just saying, I'm not going to go hide in the corner. You know, I have something to contribute.
So you've decided you have an issue you care about. You have something you want to say. Where do you begin?
For instance, I have a story in the book about a woman named Deanna Archuleta who, from New Mexico, and, you know, she was the proverbial, you know, neighborhood mom, and there wasn't a sign at a street crossing, and so she worked to get one. And then everybody said, well, she was such a great leader, why don't you run for the PTA? And then she did that, and then they asked her to run for county board, and she did that. And then she ended up being an advisor to one of the cabinet secretaries. So, you know, pick an issue you care about, figure out what needs to be done, organize the plan to make it happen. Another option, which increasingly women are choosing, is they look at, you know, what, say, a state senator does or a state rep or whatever, and they say, I want to do that, which is historically what men have done. If you are a woman who mobilizes other women to be your supporters and supports women's causes, that is definitely a winning strategy.
And do you find that women leaders do lead differently, or is it just personality case by case?
Recently, there have been some articles in which, for instance, there was one in the Times talking about, you know, the women U.S. senators have a dinner once a month, and, you know, it's an across the aisle kind of a thing, and among other things, they identify issues they can work on together, and apparently there's no such similar dinner among the men. Of course, it would be a lot bigger group. And some of the senators have been quoted as saying, well, you know, we're quicker to reach a place where, you know, a common agenda can be found. And I've certainly heard other women officials say that, you know, historically there have been bipartisan women's caucuses in the state legislatures around the country. It's gotten somewhat harder in some states because of the sort of, you know, there's been a greater move to the right on the Republican side, and so a less of a willingness to collaborate with Democrats.
So what do you predict for the 2016 presidential election? Are we going to see at least one woman and maybe more?
I can't believe that we won't. You know, I have to tell you, this is like about a year ago or something, I was reading one of the political columns, and it was kind of like, this person's sort of first take on who really might run on the Democratic side for president, or perhaps it was positioned as able to run. And the article, I believe, listed Secretary Clinton, Secretary Napolitano, Senator Gillibrand, Senator Klobuchar. There may have even been one or two other people. And I just literally jumped up and down in my chair. You know, that's on the Democratic side. And then on the Republican side, you know, the article mentioned the governor of South Carolina and the governor of New Mexico, you know, Senator Iowa from New Hampshire. So it's hard to imagine that out of all of that, and there are probably some other names I, you know, don't even know about, that there won't be some some women who venture out in 2016.
Rebecca Sive is the author of Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide to Winning Any Office from the PTA to the White House. Up next, heading to Utah to explore the future of Mormons in politics and Native Americans reclaiming stewardship of land once thought lost forever. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1261. Mitt Romney has said his presidential aspirations are over, but he's been meeting with donors and senior campaign leaders and said he would help out GOP candidates in 2013, in the midterm elections, and in the 2016 presidential race. Romney's Mormon moment in American politics has opened doors once thought tightly shut. KFAI's Gemma Brown went to Salt Lake City to find out about the political future for Mormons.
Not surprisingly, it was hard to get anyone on the record to talk about politics and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Invariably, I was led through the official channels all the way up to the senior manager of public relations for the Latter-day Saints Church before being connected to Professor Quinn Monson, the director of the Center of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Over the phone, Professor Monson said Romney's two presidential bids in 2008 and again in 2012 have changed how non-Mormon Americans view Mormonism.
Even though he didn't win, he did reasonably well, and there's not a lot of evidence that religion was a huge factor in his loss. The attention given to Romney's religion, it was, I think, less hostile in 2012.
And Monson isn't the only one who holds that opinion.
My name is Crystal Young Otterstrom. I am the state chair of LDS Democrats, which stands for Latter-day Saint, which is our lesser-known name as Mormons.
Even though Romney wasn't on her ticket, Young Otterstrom said Romney's openness about his Mormonism helped break a proverbial glass ceiling.
I don't think if someone else comes up who runs for president, there's going to be such a, can a Mormon win? You know, what is Mormonism? When I went to graduate school in New York. Nobody knew what a Mormon was. Nobody knew what Mormonism was. I really felt like I was on a mission. And people, and even just being a churchgoer was odd.
I had to admit, it was odd to meet Young Otterstrom and have my vision of who Mormons are challenged by the self-titled progressive Mormon feminist with a bright red pixie cut. I had to ask her the obvious question.
The idea of a Mormon Democrat sounds kind of oxymoronic. Can you explain how it is or it isn't?
I mean, for me, this is where I am because of my Mormonism, to quote Senator Reid, and not in spite of it. But I mean, I'm here because my religion talks all the time about reaching out to the poor and needy. That's one of our four purposes of the gospel, even. And I believe Democrats do a better job of that. I'm here because I believe that God is no respecter of persons. And certainly historically, you know, Republicans and Democrats both have muddy histories there. But I think right now we're clearly the more diverse party.
Young Otterstrom said there aren't many LDS Democrats. Only a slim 7% of Utah's Mormon population votes Democratic. But she was adamant that there is more political diversity among Mormons today than an outsider might think.
Social media didn't exist when I was first becoming a Democrat, but now we exist, so you can't feel like you're the only Mormon Democrat in your ward anymore. You can now reach out to the potentially million of us.
Young Otterstrom said it was fortuitous Mitt Romney ran for office a year after the LDS Democratic Caucus was formed, because his campaign helped shine a media spotlight on Mormon politicians. However, Young Otterstrom is not proud of the image of Mormon leadership Romney has offered the American public.
A lot of Mormons are saying, you know, it's good that he ran so we had the attention, but it's good that he lost so we didn't have that constant scrutiny, because everything he would be what he would have done as a president would have also been viewed under that, this is what Mormons do.
With Romney out of the picture, who will be the next politician to represent Mormon values on the national level? Professor Monson said he doesn't see anyone immediately filling Mitt Romney's shoes.
I don't think John Huntsman is done yet. Harry Reid, who's in the Senate, is an active Mormon. But it's hard to pick. I don't see a rising star immediately beyond the characters we already have.
Both Monson and Young Otterstrom insist this isn't the last we'll see of Mormons making strides in politics. But without another election cycle on the immediate horizon, it seems the Mormon moment may have diminished with its most familiar ambassador. For KFAI, I'm Gemma Brown.
And finally, policy that's taking generations to change. Each year, wildfires destroy thousands of acres of land in the U.S. This year, the August wildfires in central Idaho were among some of the worst officials say they've ever seen. The hot, dry summer had already been estimated to have seen about $1 billion in damages from fires around the country. But there was a time when those lands were managed, and fires weren't as wild. Hundreds of years ago, the land north of the Feather River in the mountains of California's Plumas and Lassen counties was filled with villages of native Mount Maidu people. After the gold rush, prospectors, developers, and government agencies took over their land. Their population dwindled, and the tribe lost access to the land for traditional practices. Now, the Mount Maidu people are working with an old adversary to regain formal stewardship of their homeland. Lisa Morehouse reports.
Danny Manning walks up a steep hill near Taylorsville, on Indian trust land that's been in his family for generations. To the right, it's dark, thick with trees and other growth, but the left side is open and clear with neat piles of thinned brush, which a crew will carefully burn.
When we first started this project, you couldn't even see 20 feet in front of you. Now you could see like 100 yards up the hill.
600. Today, Berkeley.
Manning is the assistant fire chief of the Greenville Rancheria, which is like a reservation. He brought in a small fire crew to tend this land in native ways.
Yeah.
I think we already hit the worst of the brush, really.
Yeah.
That here is the worst.
Yeah.
They're taking out sugar pines and brush, providing space for oaks to encourage the growth of acorns, a traditional Maidu food source. All throughout this region, Manning says, are plants for teas, even poison oak remedies.
Anybody else would, you know, walk through here and say, oh, this is beautiful, this is nice land, and we look around and see stuff we could use, and we still use it.
Land stewardship, he says, is essential to Maidu's survival. But there's very little land in Maidu ownership, except for some private land and some, like this, that's held in trust by the U.S. government. Many Mountain Maidu aren't part of federally recognized tribes. Plus, there's a long history of attempts to keep Maidu from their cultural and ecological practices.
My grandma's generation, they weren't allowed to practice their native ways because they were in boarding schools and stuff. A lot of it was almost lost forever, but, you know, we're coming back in a big way.
One sign of that comeback is on a much larger project, over 2,000 acres in Plumas and Lassen National Forests. That's where Maidu and the U.S. Forest Service, historically not your typical allies, are co-managing land. In 1998, Congress awarded the Maidu Culture and Development Group a pilot project here to use traditional ecological knowledge on this land.
These are healthy plants because they're not crowding each other. They're kind of spread out.
Lorena Gorbett climbs up a hill to sit in an abundant field of bear grass used for Maidu basket making. She says there's a reason the land always provided the Mountain Maidu all the materials they needed for daily living.
It was because we took care of the land and everything on it, and it took care of us.
Gorbett says communicating that with the Forest Service was tough at first.
They said, well, what are you going to do? When are you going to do it? What's your time frame? What's your budget? And we said, well, we won't know what the land needs till we go out and talk to it and listen to it. And it will tell us what it needs and when it needs it.
We are a federal government agency, so we do have a lot of policies and direction that we have to follow.
That's Wade McMaster, Tribal Relations Program Manager for Plumas and Lassen National Forests.
If you look at how tribes do things, it's much more from the heart and from the spirit. And that's been kind of a learning experience for us to try to get that integration to work.
Maidu planted gray willow, eradicated noxious weeds, cleared thick brush, and cut timber. But there have been major gaps in the work due to internal arguments among Maidu themselves and conflicts over the contract with the Forest Service. Now, they've resolved their differences and work has resumed. Danny Manning and a Maidu crew from the Greenville Rancheria are thinning and piling this area, just like they did on his family's trust land. And the Forest Service and Mountain Maidu are working together to enhance bear grass growth. Maidu hope to practice native ecology on an even bigger scale in nearby Humbug Valley.
This vast valley was plumb full of Maidu villages. And there was a time when my grandmother said that at nighttime you could see many flickering fires all around this great valley.
Beverly Ogle says she can trace her Humbug Valley roots back at least five generations. This large mountain meadow east of Greenville is rimmed by forest and contains mineral springs and the lovely Yellow Creek. It's owned by PG&E, but unlike other nearby valleys, it was never flooded for hydroelectric power. And as part of PG&E's huge bankruptcy settlement after the state's energy crisis, Humbug Valley will be conserved and may be donated to a new landowner.
I would like to see it fall back in the hands of our Mountain Maidu people so we can once again be stewards of this land. It'll never be the same, but pretty near.
Ogle's with the nonprofit Maidu Summit Consortium, which is vying for Humbug Valley. In their proposal, the group envisions this as a vast park where they can demonstrate and share native ecology and culture with the public and protect cultural and sacred sites. Maidu raised alarm this fall when PG&E logged hundreds of acres in Humbug Valley. They claim logging occurred within ancient village sites and broke a traditional grinding stone.
I almost begged at least a small part of this world to return it to our Maidu people so we can once again have a land base to practice our culture.
Practice customs like the annual bear dance, a traditional ceremony and gathering. Each summer, about 200 Mountain Maidu people and friends meet at a campground to eat, tell stories, and make flutes from elderberry branches. Even though this gathering is taking place on an old Mountain Maidu village site, they have to reserve this campground now. Beverly Ogle says she hopes to see bear dances in Humbug Valley someday. A nonprofit stewardship council is evaluating the proposals for Humbug Valley's future. Mountain Maidu hope that at its meeting in September, the council will recommend that they assume ownership.
That report comes to us courtesy of After the Gold Rush Radio. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there. And you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.